Hello and welcome to Answer Me This. Thank you for listening.
If you've just heard some ads, please know we do not control which commercials you get to hear.
But now they're done, here is an episode of Answer Me This. Hello and welcome to Answer Me This. Thank you for listening.
If you've just heard some ads, please know we do not control which commercials you get to hear.
But now they're done, here is an episode of Answer Me This.
If there's live-action Fantasia, who'll play the broom?
Should I put a tenner on Orlando Bloom?
Before we begin formal proceedings, Helen, I have a quick Disney World clarification to make of the kind that you will really struggle to pretend you give a shit about.
Are you sure it's going to be quick? Because from what I gather, people are very, very steamed up in extreme detail about the issue you're about to raise.
The feedback has been extensive, but I think it can be dealt with quickly. You will recall in the last episode, Matt from Austin asked me about a ride at Epcot that featured animatronic scenes depicting farming in the future. He thought it was Spaceship Earth, and indeed it might have been, for reasons I dealt with in the episode. But anyway, as you suggest, Helen, literally dozens of you have been in touch with quite detailed emails.
Quite detailed.
Quite a lot of detail. To say that Matt might have actually been remembering the now permanently closed ride Horizons, which opened in 1983, closed in 1994, and amazingly was originally called Future Probe.
What?
When did its name change in its short lifespan?
That was at the drawing board stage, but I think they were quite far into the build before they decided that it might be problematic to have a family attraction called anything Probe.
Especially in the 90s when people were so into the idea of being probed by aliens.
In the bum, usually.
Yes, Martin, in the bum, thanks.
It closed in 1994, but it opened in 1983. So I don't know if probing was so big then.
But Matt said he went to Disney World in 1996. So how could he be remembering Future Probe Horizons?
Ah, well, okay. I really don't want to return to this feedback again. But I mean,
absolutely not.
I did deal in the episode with the fact that it might have been Spaceship Earth he was remembering, and it might have been. But equally, if he got his dates wrong, then as all of you say, it might also have been Horizons. Can we leave it at that? Because it's the memories of one man. We can't really validate it. We've never even met him.
And even when we were reading his question, you had to mark Matt as an unreliable narrator of his own life.
Quite right.
Some of the facts already didn't check out. So all we know is there's a guy called Matt who's been to Disney World at least twice.
Yeah.
And went on some rides.
Anyway, in much more serious feedback, we have this in from Meredith in Canberra, who has a microwave cookery suggestion for Georgianne in Washington, D.C.
Oh, yes. Georgianne, who only has a microwave and a fridge at her disposal in her rental room for the next 2 months.
Yes. Meredith says, there is hope.
Yes.
I like to get into a...
We all need
his
hope.
His name is Jesus. Praise be to God.
How do you cook Jesus in a microwave? That's not nice. I've been through a lot already.
I like to get into work early, she says, and I can do wonders cooking breakfast in our office kitchen.
Meredith, you nightmare. Everyone comes into the office and it stinks of egg because of you.
In the office kitchen, they have a microwave, a toaster, and a sandwich press.
All you need.
Last year, a few of us did an office breakfast on the last working day before Christmas, and I made Eggs Benedict for eight of us using the microwave.
That's impressive.
Also, that is high summer in Australia, the last working day before Christmas.
I guess the butter will just melt itself.
She says, I have a foolproof microwave hollandaise sauce. And then she sent us the link, Helen. I've looked, and it does involve a handheld electric whisk. So I'm not sure, again, that really is something that Georgianne has access to.
Eggs Benedict, a really tricky thing to get right, because you have to have the hollandaise ready at exactly the right moment and the poached eggs ready at exactly the right moment. So whatever appliances you have, it's a tough dish.
Meredith continues, you can poach eggs in the microwave using either a purpose-built poacher or just by cracking an egg in a mug of boiling water and microwaving it. Now, is that true?
I'm very impressed if so, especially if she manages to get eight done for the same serving time.
I cooked baby spinach, she says, by putting it in a colander and pouring boiling water over it. Now that's just... I mean, of all the ingredients in her Eggs Benedict, surely the spinach is the easiest one to microwave.
The microwave's busy with the eggs and the hollandaise.
Well, couldn't you line a small cup or bowl with spinach and then crack an egg into it and poach it that way and then cook the spinach at the same time?
Very watery.
Oh, that's a good point, I suppose.
Alternative foolproof recipe, buy a bag of crisps and eat those.
I don't know if you can get Eggs Benedict flavour crisps. You probably can somewhere in the world.
Oh, probably. Martin bought spaghetti bolognese crisps the other week, and you wouldn't think that that could be powerfully disgusting, and yet...
They're sweeping the nation in New Zealand.
The smell filled the room, so it probably is sweeping the nation.
I thought it was quite good.
Nasty.
Hello, Helen and Ollie and Martin the Soundman. My name's also Helen, and I have a mate called Ollie, but not one called Martin. I was wondering about scratch cards. See, I just bought a scratch card in the newsagent, and I was thinking, they have all these reels of scratch cards. How do the newsagents pay for them? And what stops them just going through and scratching all the scratch cards and then taking a scratch card that wins like £1 million to the neighbouring newsagent and saying they were just a customer? I mean, do they pay for them one by one, or do they just sort of get... How does it work?
If you could cover the cost of multiple scratch card purchases by simply scratching them all, then no one would work for a living, would they? That's what everyone would do. And the National Lottery wouldn't have a business. So clearly, despite the fact you might win small prizes along the way and you've got a small chance of winning the big prize, the whole process is designed so that overall you would make a loss so that they make a profit. That's how it works.
Also, does it not cost the newsagents to have these items?
Yeah, they've paid for the scratch cards and they make a profit on the sale of each one, but only 6%.
Oh, really?
Well, that's sensible, because if the wholesale price was a lot cheaper than the retail price, they could go like, oh, well, okay, like it doesn't make sense for punters to buy 1,000 scratch cards, but it does make sense for a newsagent who's getting like a 50% discount to buy 1,000 scratch cards.
Yeah, I think they pay £1 for the scratch card that they sell for £1, and then later they claim 6% back from Camelot at the end of the year for all the cards they've sold for that reason. I did, though, see a blog in which someone did buy 500 scratch cards just to see what would happen.
Wow.
She actually won £301.
Oh.
So she lost 199.
That's gambling.
Which is about the ratio that I'd expect. That's gambling. Because the chance of winning a prize is usually about 1 in 4.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously that is what's advertised. But clearly the 1 in 4 is not the chance of winning the jackpot. They don't advertise what the odds are on winning the jackpot. Even if you go on the Camelot website, you don't find the odds on winning the jackpot. You find out how many jackpot prizes there are, and you have to do the calculations yourself.
Right.
And it's really hard to work it out. And it could well be that the jackpot has already been won, because there's not an electronic display in the newsagent, is there? So you're still chasing something that was won 2 months ago. That's quite possible. I think that is on their website, but who the fuck checks the website?
Okay, that's another question. How long can the newsagents keep a particular kind of scratch card? Can they sell ones that are like 8 years old?
Yeah, I believe so. Because, yeah, the jackpot hasn't changed, has it? It's a analog mechanic. So I don't see what the issue with that would be. But like I say, you'd be wise to check online to see whether the prize has been claimed. And now, of course, they're trying to get people to do the online scratch cards, which removes surely the only pleasure in scratching a card, which is getting the little silver dust all over your
finger. Yes! Outrageous. How does that work then? Do you scratch your phone screen with your thumbnail?
You probably just tap it, don't you? But isn't it funny, like, even though it's exactly the same company offering exactly the same product, somehow, when it's the card version, there's an authenticity to it. Like, if you trust them that there are £5 million prizes, you genuinely don't know until you scratch it off and it's physically in your hand, it was made in the factory. It's the Willy Wonka thing, isn't it? You could have the golden ticket. And yet, when you're on the internet, it's exactly the same. There's just the same odds that they're going to give that one to you randomly on the computer. But you don't trust it as much, do you?
I think that's the thing with physical objects. There's a presence, and automatically you trust that more than something that is virtual.
Yeah.
And also, there's a limited supply of the physical object, whereas the online version could be infinite.
Here's a question from Amelia, who says, Helen, answer me this. Who first designed those little round pin cushions? You know what I'm talking about, Helen.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know what she's talking about?
Round pin cushions.
They're usually about the size and shape of a satsuma, with brightly coloured little people arranged all around the edge.
Yeah.
And I think they're filled with sawdust or something.
I do know the thing she's talking about.
You keep pins for sewing and stuff in them, do you? Is that the idea?
Yeah, because when you're sewing, you often don't have time to take a pin and put it in a box or something. You need to stab it into a cushion. And also, some of them have sand or sawdust in, and you put the pin in and it gets sharpened by that. So there's a function as well as cushionality.
That's clever. I wish they did something similar like that for DIY.
Or like a screwdriver cushion.
Yeah. Because very often when you're like trying to nail something into the wall, like, well, I say when you, as if this is everyone's experience. I'm terrible at DIY. So when I try and hammer something into the wall, I get through five nails that all bend and break and make a bigger hole in my wall than I was intending to. Mm. And those are the ones that I then have to do something with. And I've got kids, so I don't want to put them on the floor. I've got the kitten wandering around now. So I have to like put it in my back pocket and then I might sit on it and get it in my ass. I would like a DIY pincushion for those nails.
What about a blob of blue tack?
Yeah, I suppose so, although then it looks like a voodoo doll, doesn't it?
That's a useful secondary function. Oh, you can get magnetic pincushions, which is just, it's not really a cushion. It's just a pincushion-sized magnet, and you could get one of those for your nails until you have time to safely dispose of them.
So Amelia says, who makes these weird little things, and why has something so surreal and specific and complicated endured?
I've got really awful news, and it is that I spent hours trying to find the answers to these questions, and I couldn't. I am devastated. I know that these pincushions go back to at least the 30s, because I saw them being sold on antique sites with that attribution. Mm. And there are some where they're saying it's Chinese babies holding hands, and somewhere it's like, this is from Japan, and it's sumo wrestlers holding hands.
But okay, well, just before you go any further, do they, because I can't quite visualize this, do they look Asian? Do they look like they could be Chinese or Japanese, the characters?
Well, it's their faces are pointing inwards, and they're sort of done on a stereotype, so the sumo wrestlers will have the high hair. So yeah, sure. But also the fabric is like Asian silk.
Okay, so it's legit that it might come from that part of the world then?
Oh yeah, I think okay. It does come from that part of the world, but I can't find out why that design is a thing. It's a very common pincushion shape because it lacks weak spots, and also you can pack it like really dense. So another very common pincushion design is a tomato that has a little strawberry dangling off it, and people on the internet are up in arms. They're like, why is it a strawberry? You never see a strawberry growing out of a tomato.
Hear, hear.
And the strawberry contains the emery for sharpening the needles.
There is no place for whimsy in my very serious world of sewing.
But then there's this very pervasive myth that I can't really get confirmation on, that the reason why the tomato ones exist is because in the mid-1800s, it was considered good luck to put a tomato on a mantelpiece in your house to ward off evil spirits or something.
Okay.
But a lot of people didn't have access to real tomatoes, or they would rot, so they would make them out of red fabric. But that sounds like bollocks to me. I think it's just a tomato is an easy shape to make out of red fabric and put pins in.
Do you think that's where the squeezy ketchup bottle came from as well?
To keep
not
away
just a fun plastic shape spirits. In a 50s diner, but to keep away evil spirits. Yeah,
well, now I do.
So, okay. So, all right. You've got far enough to say maybe it's from Asia.
Yes, I think it's actually from Asia, but I wonder whether it is catering to a westernized taste for orientalist knickknacks.
So that would explain the sort of boom in popularity in the early 20th century. I just wonder, in all of your hours of Googling, whether at least you've managed to determine a name for this object.
No.
Rather than just thing, pincushion.
Not
thing.
Even. Sometimes it's like Chinese baby pincushion. Sometimes Japanese sumo wrestler pincushion.
And there wasn't even like a subreddit about pincushions where people discuss this in detail?
There's a lot of pincushion chat about the tomato pincushions, let me tell you. I went deep cushion that day. I also found ads for a 1940s pincushion, which is like a little statuette of Adolf Hitler with a pincushion for his bum.
Huh.
Apparently President Roosevelt had one because he thought it was so amusing. Where are all the comedy pincushions now, eh?
I bet there's Donald Trump ones.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Bet there are, especially on Etsy. I bet that's someone's livelihood, making Donald Trump pin cushions. I don't even need to Google it. I know it is. I know it to be true. I got a question. Email your question to answer me this podcast at googlemail.com. Answer me this podcast at googlemail.com. Answer me this podcast at googlemail.com.
So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Monday is the anniversary of the day Roger first published his famous thesaurus.
Then on Tuesday, we say happy birthday, Mr. Potato Head.
On Wednesday, the extraordinary stories of the child soldiers who fought in the American Civil War.
On Thursday, how King James changed the word of God.
And on Friday, what did spam emails look like in 1978?
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Here's a question from Jonathan from Exeter, who says, Ollie, answer me this. Is the yearly Blue Peter appeal still a thing? And what is the highest amount it ever raised?
The annual Blue Peter appeal is no longer an annual event, no. Although it was revived last year for the 60th anniversary of Blue Peter. But the Blue Peter appeal, it's hugely influential amongst fundraisers today because it did a lot of things for the first time. It started in 1958, like a good 20 years before anyone had really seen a telethon before. And it also, looked at now, seems quite ahead of its time because it was very democratizing. It wasn't just about kids contributing money to the show to help other children in need around the world. You could contribute things like bottle tops or stamps, which feels, to me, very 2019. Like the whole concept of A, recycling, and B, sort of everyone democratically being able to participate in the same way, in some small way, to contribute towards a target so that they're on board with the idea, even if in reality it's going to be, you know, a handful of big donors that are going to make the difference. That's exactly how fundraising happens now, isn't it?
But also it's very powerful to get children involved because children can pester their parents. And also every time they see a bottle top, they can be thinking about a charitable cause.
Yeah. It came out of Biddy Baxter, the sort of legendary producer of Blue Peter, who was on it for like 40 years, looking one Christmas at all the toys lying dejected and unused around the studio one year. Because they used to do, you know, it's a children's magazine show. So come Christmas time, they basically do, here are the toys you can pester your parents for this Christmas.
Yeah.
And she looked around in 1958 at the toys they had lying around and just thought, why don't we give these toys to poor children instead of telling our middle-class children who are watching what they should get for Christmas? And that was where the concept came from. It was like, next Christmas, let's do a campaign where we get everyone involved in giving and try and spread that message. Also, the totalizer. Again, something that you're really used to seeing on telly now, the idea of having a goal that you're aiming at, like Kickstarter as well. I mean, it's really influential. You've got this chart and you can see at the top what they're aiming for.
So that's like the big thermometer where they would colour in a bit more for all the money that came in.
Blue Peter essentially invented that and also invented the idea that the target at the top isn't the real target. So they'd have a target at the top of, like, by the 1980s, let's say at the top it said 100 grand.
Yeah.
But then when they got to 100 grand, there'd be a second totalizer that went up to 500,000. And it's because kids, you know, don't want to hang on for 2 months to reach the target. But the psychology remains whatever age you are, doesn't it? Like, you want to reach the top and you're only going to reach the top if you feel it's got momentum.
Yeah, and also people are more inclined to give money to a thing that's already demonstrated that people want to give money to it.
Yeah, exactly.
Classic Kickstarter techniques.
But anyway, to answer Jonathan's question directly as to what is the highest amount it ever raised, that information is quite hard to come by. I have even contacted the BBC Children's Press Office for an answer on this. And basically they said, they've got a live show today. They haven't got time to answer your question on that.
Unbelievable.
But the press office gave me some information about the history of the Blue Peter appeal. So this is all they have ready to hand. They don't know the answer as to what's been the most successful appeal ever. But they do know that across the 49 Blue Peter appeals, they've raised the equivalent of £100 million in today's money. But that's a bit of a fudge stat, isn't it? Because obviously, what does today's money mean? They've obviously worked out with inflation and everything else.
Yeah.
And it's kind of complicated. So the only fact that I can find from a charity's website online, and obviously some of the charities Blue Peter was supporting in 1958 no longer exist, but from an individual charity online boasting about how much they raised through the Blue Peter appeal, the best example I can find is Sight Savers. Mm-hmm. In fact, so successful was the Blue Peter appeal for Sight Saver in 1986 that the charity that had previously been called the Royal Commonwealth Society for the Blind actually changed its name to the name of the appeal, Sight Savers. They raised £2 million in 1986.
Wow.
From bring and buy sales.
Wow.
Yeah. Original target of 100 grand, and then they did 32,000 bring and buy sales around the country.
I suppose bring and buy sales, though, the overheads are low because you're not paying anything for the product.
And you're outsourcing it, aren't you? It's not like the BBC had to pay to rent the village hall. Like, you're saying to kids, ask your teacher if you can use the space, then bring along all your old shit. So it costs the BBC nothing. They just get the income.
But there's no outlay for the product either. So that, I suppose, is people's contribution as well, isn't it? I told Martin something the other day that really upset him, which is when I was about five, I went to a bring and buy sale in the local village hall and I found one of my toys for sale there. And I said to my mum, how did this get here? And she said, I thought you didn't want it anymore.
Ooh.
But she hadn't asked. Devastating.
What was the toy?
A soft toy of a tortoise. made out of like brown canvas. It wasn't very soft and cuddly. It was just a big round tortoise. I think it was on for 50p.
Do you now credit her with telling you the truth?
Well, I don't think she had any other option.
Because she could have just said, oh, that's not your one. You've got one a bit like that, but it's not that one.
Yeah, the thing is, it definitely was that one because it was an unusual creature. It wasn't the kind of thing where all of your friends had one. It was a brown canvas toy tortoise. Probably with some 70s patterns on the shell.
I sort of secretly take some of Harvey's toys to the hospice shop when I drop him at nursery on a weekly basis, and he hasn't noticed yet.
Don't take him in there to buy toys then.
Although if I did, I would just say, oh yeah, you've got one of those, but I guess it wouldn't be a canvas tortoise. It's things like an early learning centre plastic telephone,
yeah,
which in itself is a telephone box, which we don't really have anymore, so he doesn't even know what the object is supposed to be mimicking, that doesn't work because I couldn't change the batteries because the screws rusted. And so you think, he's not enjoying this. But actually, like, a baby who's not bothered about whether or not it makes a noise when you press it and doesn't know what the object is, it's just a shiny lump of plastic, for 50p would probably be distracted by that. It's things like that. But if he knew that I was giving it away, we wouldn't be able to leave the house, you know.
I suppose what you could do is you could have a kind of halfway house for the toys. So the ones that you think he doesn't care about, you remove from his room. But if he asks about it, then you've still got them so he doesn't feel like you've betrayed him because you haven't taken it away permanently.
A kind of purgatory.
Right, exactly. And if he hasn't requested one of the toys in purgatory for a month, then you can take it.
Purgatory.
Purgatory. This is a plan.
The 14 bring and buy sales have raised the equivalent of an estimated £57 million. Other items collected by the appeal include over 948 million stamps.
Wow.
19 million aluminium cans.
What do they do with the cans?
And over 1.4 million pairs of shoes.
Wow.
Including David Beckham's boots. I presume that was a celebrity donation rather than child David Beckham sending them in and then bothering to recognise that years later. Between 1962 and 2010, the appeals raised money to buy, amongst others, 2 guide dogs, 25 lifeboats, 8 flats for homeless people, 32 ponies, 57 lorries, 3 caravans, 2 day centres, 6 bungalows, 12 houses in Romania, 3 schools, and 8,350 what, Helen?
8,350... Ooh, mosquito nets?
Oh, that's such a good guess.
Wells?
I mean, it's not actually close, but that's... Oh my God, you're on fire. Toilets.
Oh, brilliant.
But you were really close, I think, with mosquito nets and wells. Like, toilets is in the middle of that Venn diagram,
I just went a little too far. That's very impressive. How many stamps to build a Romanian school?
Yeah, that's the bit I don't understand. How did they convert the stamps into cash? I know the stamps have a cash value. I mean, it's not very efficient, really, is it?
No. And the bottle tops, when they were doing that, collect bottle tops or ring pulls or whatever the fuck it was.
Yeah.
Do they melt that down?
I don't know. I don't know.
I'm an influencer. You want to be who I am. You envy everything on my Instagram, but it's all stock photos. My life's a total sham. I can't even do yoga.
But I'm a real health expert. I use Squarespace. All my photos and advice are all in the one place. And I built a store so you can buy into my taste. $8 smoothies.
Thank you to Squarespace for sponsoring this episode of Answer Me This.
And making it easy for you guys out there, everybody, to build a beautiful website.
Everybody, yes, please build a website that's not shit.
If you want to make a website, they make it easy for you to find photos to accompany your blog. They make it easy for you to sell your products through your store page. They make it easy for you to market your website on Google. I mean, basically, there's nothing they haven't made easy.
And so if you have an idea for a website, but you've been dragging your heels despite listening to us talking about Squarespace since you were born, go to squarespace.com/answer, have a go on the 2-week free trial, and then when you sign up, you can get a 10% discount off your first purchase of a website or domain using our code
ANSWER. And to the person who wrote to us saying, oh, I've been listening to Answer Me This for ages, and now I'm going to get a Squarespace website, but should I be using your code? Because yes. I listen to some smaller podcasts that I might want to support.
Ooh.
Or what about the show that I first heard the Squarespace promo code on? Which one should I use? Like, fuck off! Don't write to us and ask should you deny us. Yes, use our code.
I get people saying, should I use the Answer Me This code or the Illusionist code? I can't answer that question for you.
Follow your heart.
Here's a question from Mike from Jersey, who says, I love the character Sherlock Holmes, but it flabbergasts me that some of Arthur Conan Doyle's stories describe him as a regular user of cocaine. Ollie, answer me this. Was this considered normal in the 1890s?
Yes.
Was cocaine different or less potent a century ago?
No.
Or would Holmes's drug use be as scandalous to the original readers?
No.
What's the deal with Sherlock Holmes and the cocaine?
It was pretty normal, yes. I mean, Victorians took cocaine for toothache and common cold, and that's because medicine was expensive,
yeah,
and there weren't regulations, and they didn't realise how addictive cocaine was.
They only discovered it in that era, didn't they? There's a fairly short window of them discovering it in the like late 1800s and then the 1900s realising it caused a lot of psychosis. Yeah.
But it was in the Coca-Cola, wasn't it, famously?
Yeah, basically what happened is it comes from the coca plant, right? But importing cocaine then was tricky because the plant didn't travel well.
Right.
They hadn't worked out to mix it and preserve it.
Uh-huh.
So what happened in the middle of the 19th century, a French chemist called Angelo Mariani invented a wine called Vin Mariani, which he sold as a tonic wine. They sold it as a health supplement. Mm-hmm. There's hilarious like posters with angelic children on it and stuff for this wine. And Vin Mariani was 11% alcohol and 6.5 milligrams of coke in every ounce.
That's like uppers and downers in one.
It's basically a Jägermeister and Red Bull, isn't it? That's what it is.
Whoa.
And that is what Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was personally on. He was into Vin Mariani. Not just him, but Ibsen, Zola, Jules Verne, Alexander Dumas, Robert Louis Stevenson supposedly wrote The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde during a six-day cocaine binge. They were all drinking and snorting Vin Mariani. And actually not just authors and artists, but like Queen Victoria and the Pope at the time were into this. And then what happened is in America they had prohibition.
Mm.
And so Coca-Cola came out of a version of a kind of American tonic wine that was developed in response to prohibition. They took the alcohol out, but they kept the Coke in until 1904.
Right, and then they replaced the Coke with caffeine, didn't they?
But in any case, in terms of Sherlock, it wouldn't have been shocking because it's A, something that the audience understood, and B, it's a way of accounting for his obsessive genius, isn't it?
He's a little overstimulated, seeming, sure.
It explains why he keeps working through the night, why he keeps persistently and doggedly, you know, uncovering the same clue that everyone else has missed and finding something new in it, because even though they didn't understand the addictive qualities of cocaine then, they knew that cocaine, I mean, I've never taken it, but it essentially seems to keep you feeling like you haven't taken anything, even though everyone can see that you have, and you go a bit manic and you just keep going and going and going. That's what Sherlock's doing, isn't it?
I suppose if you were writing it now, you might have him on Adderall.
Yeah.
Or something like that. I think conversely, it's hard for us to understand in the modern day how things like absinthe then,
yeah,
they were considered to be destroying society.
Yeah. Well, so was gin, wasn't it?
And gin.
I mean, just the availability of cheap spirits.
Yeah, but absinthe in particular was like a really trippy.
We have another question of literature from Becky in Ilkley, who says, I recently reread Jane Austen's Emma.
Mm-hmm.
Have you recently reread Jane Austen's Emma?
I haven't read it for quite some time because it was never a book I hugely enjoyed because I found it, I have read it a few times, but I found it increasingly nihilist. I think because Emma is so privileged, she has nothing really to fill her time except for making everything worse.
Mm.
And I found that hard to return to with pleasure.
Well, I have recently not read it.
I've watched Clueless many times over the years, so, you know, I feel like I've still got the plot fresh in my memory.
And Becky continues, it struck me for the first time reading it this time that Mr. Frank Churchill's aunt seems to die at an awfully convenient moment and quite unexpectedly.
Mm.
This is how Austen writes her death in the novel. Though her nephew had had no particular reason to hasten back on her account, she had not lived above 6 and 30 hours after his return. 6 and 30 hours, that's a day and a half, isn't it, in posh words? A sudden seizure of a different nature from anything foreboded by her general state had carried her off after a short struggle.
Mm-hmm.
Becky says, this sounds to me highly suspicious, Moreover, Mr. Frank Churchill is at that time in a pretty desperate position as regards his engagement to Jane Fairfax. She has threatened to end their engagement. I sound like one of the Radio 4 announcers introducing the Archers. She has threatened to end their engagement and go away to become a governess. He receives this news on the day of his aunt's death. The death of his aunt means it's all back on. Is that really a coincidence? Helen, answer me this. Is Mr. Frank Churchill a murderer?
This is like when you see one of those YouTube videos that has taken like the trailer to a classic rom-com and put a menacing soundtrack over it. You're like, oh my God, it is a horror film.
Yeah.
Just really cast the book in a different light. I should recap what is happening with these characters.
Or just cap.
Right? Because in Clueless, there's not a direct analogue for these people.
Sure.
Frank is sort of Christian, the guy she fancies, but he's gay. But there's no Jane Fairfax and dead aunt business happening. So what it is, right? Frank Churchill is Emma's friend's stepson, but was brought up by his aunt, which was pretty common in Jane Austen's time. So if one of your siblings was rich but childless, you'd send one of your children to live with them and be raised as their own child. Mm-hmm. So he's back in town to visit his father. Jane Fairfax is an orphan, also in town, visiting her aunts. And she's not rich. So now that she is of adult age, she is soon going to have to either get married or become a governess, which she doesn't really want to do.
Which in Austen world means stakes are high.
Right, stakes are high for Jane. Jane and Frank are secretly engaged, and it's secret because Frank's aunt wouldn't approve of him marrying a poor person. The aunt is in bad health, so they are waiting for her to die so they can marry. So this is what the quotation means when it says, of a different nature from anything foreboded by her general state. It's saying she was ill anyway, but what killed her doesn't seem to have been related.
Yeah.
And then to throw people off the scent of the secret engagement, Frank keeps flirting with Emma and sort of teases Jane about crushes Jane doesn't actually have on other characters. And Frank talks about going abroad for 2 years. So Jane is upset. And then there's this scene where everyone goes on a picnic and it's all very shameful and Emma really fucks up. After that, Jane ends the engagement. She's got this governess post. Frank goes home to visit his aunt, and 3 days after the breakup, his aunt dies. So he has motive and he has opportunity. Or did Jane Austen just really need to wrap the plot up and so just remove the obstacle to Frank and Jane marrying? So taking Frank out the picture as a potential suitor for Emma so that Emma realizes she's meant to marry someone else.
Well, you see, the thing is, because of the lightness of touch in her writing, because, as you suggested, this is essentially a romantic comedy, like it's the equivalent of if Bill Pullman's character suddenly died in Sleepless in Seattle, isn't it? We're not supposed to care about this character, so it doesn't matter. I think both of the things you said are not mutually exclusive. Like, both things can be going on. She needs to wrap up plot, but also Frank Churchill could be a murderer, and it's deliberately left as light because that's not the point of the book. It's a comedy, so who cares? So actually, I think it's not a straightforward answer. The point is, yes, it is possibly implied, but through such a lightness of touch that we're deliberately not meant to care about it.
Also, the book is full of kind of riddles and puzzles and allusions, and she wouldn't really be overt about it. And also, apparently at the time, murder literature was not such a thing either.
Mm.
Like, there's no violence really in her books overtly. Also, Frank Churchill is a bit of a dick, so maybe she doesn't want to be like, God, this guy is a real dick, but she does want to imply that he's a shady dickhead.
Okay, nonetheless, Helen, you know, we have been asked specifically, not is Mr. Frank Churchill a dick, but is he a murderer? I mean, you know, pick a side.
Okay, well, I read a very interesting academic paper by Leland Monk, published in 1990, where the murder theory apparently was first put forward. And he makes a very persuasive case, and he kind of puts together a courtroom scene as if someone is cross-examining Frank and then quoting Frank from the book in that context.
Wow.
I also read another theory from someone else on the internet suggesting that Frank kills his aunt because Jane's pregnant, and so they need to hurry up and get the marriage happening.
And in conclusion?
I think if I were going to reread the book now, it would be because I thought it would be a bit more interesting to look out for clues of Frank being a murderer.
But do you think he's a murderer?
Sure, why not?
Yes. Okay, fine. Yes. Yes, why not?
I mean, no, not really.
Is that good enough for you? Yes, but not really. Brilliant. Okay.
I think either he's a murderer or Jane Austen really can't be arsed with this plot. It's like when D.H. Lawrence has just had it with a character and he's like, oh, they were sat on by a bear. You know, some really abrupt bullshit death.
Yeah. Like Drew in Neighbours.
Yes, exactly. Frank Churchill's aunt is Drew in Neighbours, but off screen.
Yep.
had an omelette station, a multitude of pools, but 30 quid for parking, WTF.
Four-star hotel.
There's Ethernet, not Wi-Fi like it's 1998, but there was a swim-up bar in the rooftop pool.
Three-star hotel.
A bit more down to earth. They did still have a pool, but it was full of kids.
Two-star hotel.
A lot more down to earth. They also had a pool, but it was full of dogs.
One-star hotel.
There's a body in the pool.
Answer me this holiday. All the fun of travelling with none of the stinky toilets or frightening food. Out now at answermethispodcast.com/albums.
If you want more fantastic Answer Me This related content, then you can go to answermethisstore.com and you can buy episodes 1 to 200, each for a very reasonable price.
And you can buy our 5 exclusive albums, content of which you will not hear elsewhere.
And those are 1 hour of Answer Me This content about a theme. So at this point of the year, you might want Answer Me This Sports Day for all the Wimble sport and foot sport and
athletic sport
and all the sporty sport that tends to happen in these months.
Also, you can support the show financially if you so choose to do. There is a button that just says donate. I mean, I'm just saying.
It's better than sending your bottle tops. We do not know how to convert those into money.
Hi, it's Alex from Sheffield here. Dear Helen and Ollie, please answer me this. How do you clean a sieve? I have one of these metal mesh sieves. Whenever I try to clean it, there's bits of rice and food and whatever it might be stuck in between the tiny little holes. I've tried going over it with a brush, hot water directly onto it, cloth, Brillo pad thing. None of it seems to really properly work.
I'm very familiar with this problem. Say if you're sifting flour for a cake.
Yes.
And there's any kind of dampness on the sieve, then that flour is going to set and stay and stay. But then, you know, you think, well, that's just a bit of sieve seasoning. Maybe that can stay around. Is that so bad?
This is my philosophy with barbecue, certainly.
Yeah. Scorch off the dirt. It's fine.
Yeah. I mean, I do. I've got a barbecue cleaning brush. But even so, once I've given it a very cursory brush, I do leave lumps of meat hanging off the grill because I think, well, that'll add flavour, won't it?
Bit of a snack for next time.
Yeah, exactly. And I think really it's almost the same, isn't it, with a sieve? I mean, it depends what you're sieving, I suppose. If you're using it instead of a colander, then you could be in dangerous territory because you get a bit of pea stuck in it or something. It's probably not good. But if you're using it as intended for things like sugar and flour, what's the problem? Get over it.
Wow, harsh words there.
Harsh but fair?
I've done the Googling that Alex fears to do. And I'm not sure that any of these solutions are going to revolutionise his sieve cleanliness.
Solutions as in answers rather than liquids.
Things dissolved in liquids, yeah. Well, yeah. Possibly. I suppose he could put something in so powerful that it rots the wires of the sieve and that would solve the problem in a way. This seems to be a pretty common tip. Wash it immediately. Don't leave the stuff to get hard and grow crusty.
Sure.
Some say boil it in a big pan of water. Others say simmer it. Don't bring it to the boil, but simmer it in water for half an hour with detergent. Others say pour boiling water through it to loosen the stuff and then scrub it.
So just sticking it in water as if you're sterilising it doesn't itself dislodge the stuff. It just loosens it.
Yeah.
What do you then need to dislodge? Because Alex says he uses a brush. I would say to Alex, what brush?
Well, apparently you can get a special sieve brush.
There you go.
You want one with quite tough bristles, or some people suggest a toothbrush, like a firm bristle toothbrush.
That's what I've used in the past.
Wow, it's really got, I would say, that desperate.
to be honest, it's just not, it's never concerned me. I found the answer within myself. I was like, I've got bits of things stuck in the mesh.
Right.
Toothbrush. It's a bit like teeth.
It's important to wash it upside down first.
Ah.
So convex side up first to not further embed the stuff into the sieve. You can use a power hose. You can get an ultrasonic cleaner.
Hold on. What's an ultrasonic cleaner? That sounds like something I'd have to get from NASA.
It's like a water bath that vibrates, and the vibrations get carried through the water, so anything you put in it gets vibrated as well with this high frequency.
Are you shitting me?
We used to use them in the lab all the time.
I keep getting adverts for them on Facebook.
Oh, whoa. Just stop talking about this like this is a normal thing. Are you honestly saying people get the kind of scientific equipment you would expect to see in a laboratory to clean a sieve. What's wrong with people?
What do you mean, what's right with people? It means you're not putting detergent in the water supply.
But what, I mean, how much does it cost for an ultrasonic cleaner? Bearing in mind a sieve costs a pound.
Like 20 quid? But if you bought a new sieve every time your sieve got dirty, then it would add up to more than 20 quid.
Fine, I'd still say a £3 sieve every 5 years is not that wasteful and might be better than buying a laboratory piece of equipment. That's my view.
Well, you can use it on other things.
Like what?
So, like, it's quite useful for washing things when you're travelling and you don't have a washing machine.
What? But how big is it?
Small. It's something like the size of a coffee cup that you put into a sink full of water and it does the vibrations.
Ah.
You don't put things in it.
So it's a gadget that brings the power of ultrasonic cleaning to any bowl of water.
There you go. You love gadgets. Now it's in language you can understand.
Yeah. I mean, it's a bit weird, but it's a bit like dryer balls. You know, those things you put in a dryer that make the clothes drier, allegedly. Two plastic balls with spikes on.
Yeah, but the way you said it was, you didn't say dryer balls, you said dryer balls, which is a different thing.
That's right. I've deliberately so.
Right.
Nonetheless, the product is called dryer balls.
Here's a question from Andy from Birmingham, who says, Ollie, answer me this. For as long as I can remember, I have sneezed every time I get an erection. Only ever one or two sneezes, and then I go back to behaving normally.
Very different, of course, to my experience, which is every time I sneeze, someone else gets an erection.
Andy says, this has never made any sense to me, as surely my penis and nose can't be connected in any way. Yeah, there's just a space between Andy's chin and his pelvis.
Your nose and your penis, Andy, get ready to have your mind blown. Not your nose blown.
No, it's too dangerous for him.
Both contain erectile tissue.
Wow.
And there is a link. It is a medical quirk known as sexually induced sneezing, and it is a phenomenon that was noted as early as 1897. I'm sure people noted it earlier than that, but didn't quite dare explain what was going on. And it was written about in the 1901 publication Anomalies and Curiosities of Medicine.
Right. When I was at school, I'd guess about the age of 13, there was a boy in my class called Ian. And his fun fact was that when you sneeze, you have 1/8 of an orgasm.
Yeah, oh, everyone heard that fun fact.
Right. But firstly, I don't know how you would measure the fractions.
How's that quantified?
But secondly, maybe it was physically a little more relevant than I'd assumed.
Yeah. Now, there is some serious scientific endeavour to look into this. I know this, by the way, because we've covered it on The Modern Man. It's not because I suffer from this particular complaint. There is nothing less horny than me sneezing. I did see reference to a study in 2008 when a bloke who'd contributed to the study, his marriage ended because he kept sneezing at dinner parties, which indicated to his wife that he fancied the participants.
Oh, wow. That's amazing? A very Roald Dahl adult story kind of thing.
Exactly. It kind of makes sense why you've got erectile tissue in your nose, because it does need to engorge, doesn't it, when you've got a cold and you need to expel fluid, which is a similar function.
Does it need to?
Well,
it doesn't feel more turgid in the way that an erect penis does. There's a less obvious alteration in state.
Fine, but I mean, I suppose what I'm saying is blowing your nose hard is a bit like an ejaculation of snot, isn't it?
But I'm not sure that's comparable, given that you're more conscious of the muscular process that is leading you to expel the snot than, I assume, the jism.
Okay, well, I did just compare it, Helen. I did it. I went there.
Okay.
So there you go.
I'll take your word for it, then.
There's a link. So don't worry, Andy, you are experiencing a medically documented phenomenon.
Martin sneezes when he eats an extra strong mint.
I do.
Martin, do you also come?
I mean, I don't want to say, because then when people see me eating mints and sneezing, they're going to judge me, aren't they? Only if I crunch them. If I just suck a mint, it's fine. But if I crunch the mint, I immediately sneeze.
My niece, Isabel, sneezes when she eats chocolate. What a thing the human body is, eh?
I'm an answer me this fan. I listen with my nan. She is not so keen. She finds it too obscene. I follow them on Twitter, though Ashton Kutcher's fitter. I want to take things further, just one step short of murder. I want to look like Ollie Man. I want to smell like Ollie Man. I want to be like Ollie Man. I want to chase like Ollie Man. I want to look like Ollie Man. I want to talk like Ollie Man.
Thank you.
Here's a question from Millie in Twickenham, who says, my husband, baby daughter and I are currently house-sitting for a lady called Sarah, who's currently in Australia. Mm-hmm. She has a very old dog who we're also looking after.
So you could say, if you were being more efficient, you are house and dog-sitting.
Right, okay. I'll read that again. Mm-hmm. My husband, baby daughter and I are currently house and dog-sitting for Sarah, who's currently in Australia. Yeah, that was quicker.
Thanks.
Since Sarah has been away, the dog has become quite ill, and Sarah's put us in contact with Rebecca, the dog's previous owner.
Why would you do that? The dog's ill. So get in touch with the previous owner of the dog?
I assume it's so that you have someone who knows the dog and might be able to understand more about what's wrong with the dog, or how to comfort the dog when the dog's distressed, that kind of thing.
Okay.
Has experience of the dog's health and well-being. Rebecca came to collect the dog the other day, and my husband answered the door. Rebecca mistook him for Sarah's son, Hugo, and was chatting to him about when his mum was coming back, etc. My husband's quite shy, and so didn't correct her, thinking that he wouldn't see her again, so it was harmless.
Oh, sure. It's just harmless, isn't it? Fraudulently behaving as if you're someone you're not.
This is how farces begin, and then go for five acts. However, says Millie, the dog has got worse, which means a lot more contact between Rebecca and, inverted commas, Hugo, who she now thinks is married with a young baby, when the real Hugo is actually in his last year of university with no current offspring, as far as we know, or a partner.
Mm.
Rebecca also happens to be in contact with the real Hugo via a group WhatsApp.
That's weird.
Well, you'd think she would know a bit more about Hugo, therefore, if she's on WhatsApp terms.
Exactly.
Group WhatsApp terms, no less.
Like what he looks like.
Well, he's roughly the age bracket.
But what's the group? We all know this dog?
Ollie, answer me this. How does my husband tell her who he is without making it awkward? Or does he have to live his life as Hugo now? What not awkward scenario is this? It's already awkward.
Yeah. I appreciate that this has come to a head now, because I do sort of say, it seems ridiculous to say when she knocked on the door and mistook him for someone that it was harmless to carry on and pretend to be that person in retrospect. But at the time, I do sort of see, particularly because she may have been distressed because the dog was ill, I can sort of see how you just don't want to get into it and you think this is the only time I'm going to see each other. But now that it's escalated, no, you cannot continue your life being the person that she's actually in contact with on WhatsApp separately. That's just really, really weird. So, yes, of course you have to say something. And I wonder if using the context of the distressing situation of the deteriorating dog is the context that will help you here. So rather than fronting up to what actually happened, which is that you were too shy / embarrassed to say anything, you pretend that the reason you didn't say anything was because you thought she might be confused because she was distressed about the dog and you didn't want to disrespect her feelings.
Or you could say, oh, sorry, I misheard when you said, are you Hugo? And I thought you said, are you Peter? Or whatever his real name is.
Yeah, but when she says, when's your mum coming back? What then? Mm. What did you mishear then? Like, they had a 5-minute conversation in which the context was clear as to who she thought he was. She might even suspect there's a piece of the puzzle missing, but she won't be able to say for sure. And it kind of holds up as a story, doesn't it?
Would it be possible for Millie to handle interactions with this person? And then when Rebecca says, oh, where's Hugo? You could say, well, he's at university. Oh, did you mean my husband? Oh, no, that's not Hugo, that's John. And so the woman will think it's her error rather than the husband's error. Perhaps? Do you remember years ago we had a question from a guy who used to take his kid to nursery school and he was the only male parent who was doing the drop-off and people were all saying, oh, where's your wife today? Where's your wife? And he was like, she's dead, just because he didn't want to answer the questions. Yeah. And now his wife is like, why hasn't anyone contacted me recently?
I'm guessing they're not still married.
I feel like this is one of those situations where I realise that Millie's husband was trying to be polite, but his falsehood is sort of inexcusable.
Yeah.
I suppose it is funny that it was the direction he chose to go in, but I feel like it would almost be easier for him just to pretend not to be alive than to actually address it.
Or pile on the extra lie and say that actually your name is Hugo. So that's where the confusion arose from.
But then what about his mother?
When you said, are you Hugo? Yeah, exactly. And then I thought you were asking about my mother.
Who coincidentally is also in Australia.
Yeah.
Well, listeners, this brings us to the end of another episode of Answer Me This. And for there to be future episodes, please deliver your questions to us in the form of emails or voice recordings. And our contact details are on our website,
answermethispodcast.com. And in the meantime, why not make space in your ears for our other projects? My podcast, The Modern Man, tests out trends and offers sex advice and has a middle feature interview each month. And this month, I went to New York City to meet a private investigator who specializes in busting fraudulent psychics.
That's like shooting fish in a barrel.
If you can't prove psychics are real, how can you prove that they're frauds?
I go into all that. I asked him, why is it any different to like being an evangelical church who's, you know, preying on people's vulnerabilities? It's based on a belief system, right? So what's the problem? And his answer actually, he was absolutely straight down the line. His answer was, if the church spends it, say they're going to raise the money for the roof and they spend the money on the roof, that's not fraud. It doesn't matter whether or not Jesus exists. The issue with the psychics is what they're saying is, give me £50,000 and I will cure your cursed womb. And they go and spend it on their house extension. So that's the thing. There's no you can see that what they say they're doing with it isn't what they're doing with it. That's why it's fraud. That's why it's illegal. And yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. And you can find that at modernmanwith2ns.co.uk. Martin, you have a podcast too called Song by Song.
I'm also doing a musical project called Pale Bird. And I'm putting a podcast every week called Year of the Bird, in which there's a new song. I wrote 40 songs in 2018, and I'm releasing them roughly one a week in 2019.
For one moment, Martin, when you said you're doing a musical project, I dared to believe you'd written something for Broadway.
There's 40 songs. That's a hell of a jukebox musical.
Helen's excellent podcast is called The Allusionist.
And it's available at theallusionist.org. And if you're listening to this on time, then you might just be able to catch us on tour in Australia, the last couple of shows.
And as we previously mentioned, we have a wealth of content for you to spunk your wealth upon. You can download our first 200 episodes and our exclusive albums at answermethisstore.com.
There will be a retro Answer Me This taken from the vaults in your feeds halfway through the month, but there will be a fresh new Answer Me This on the first Thursday of next month. So please return then.
Bye! Helen and Laura.